Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to Life Lessons from Sports and Beyond. My name is Simon Mundy, and let me just start with a heads up. This is a bit of a different episode than normal. I would suggest it's from the beyond part of the title. It's not going to be for everyone. It's somewhat akin to the episode I recorded with Rupert Spira. So if you enjoyed that one, this throws up similarly philosophical questions. If it's not for you, no worries. After discussing asking for help with Olympic legend Sally Gunnell last week, next week it'll be back to business as usual with ex-Arsenal and England footballer Paul Merson. But this week's guest is Sam Harris, neuroscientist, philosopher, New York Times bestselling author, host of the Making Sense podcast, and creator of the Waking Up app. And here's a question to start. Do you believe the voice in your head is who you are? Now, Sam argues that the vast majority of us believe that there is a thinker in our heads in addition to thoughts themselves. He says this is an illusion. And if we're able to see through it, we can largely bring an end to our own psychological suffering. Thoughts simply arise in consciousness on their own, Sam says, and recognizing that is immensely liberating. Anyway, we do relate this to sport at the start, before what is a deep dive into the self, questions of identity, and the nature of consciousness itself, as well as why it matters. This is the sort of episode that requires focused attention, so do grab yourself a brew, sit back, and enjoy. In the first half, Sam really sets out his stall, then I go and challenge him really in the second half, so do hang on in there. But without further ado, here is Sam Harris talking about the self-delusion. Sam Harris, how are you?
I'm great. Great. Nice to meet you, Simon.
And you. Sam, I've got to say, I'm really, really excited to have you on. And if you're going to, if you wouldn't mind just indulging me with allowing me to engage in a little light flattery just from the outset, I've really followed your work for about a decade, I would say, closely. Initially, when you were in real close cohorts with Christopher Hitchens. I used to love watching Hitch Slaps and the debates that you and he had arguing specifically with people from organized religion. Then actually around sort of 2013, my outlook changed. And lo and behold, you wrote a book that seemed to sort of fit in with that, which is your book about spirituality, Waking Up, which we'll talk about. Then obviously there's the Making Sense podcast, which is a non-negotiable in my library. You're to me the next level meditators app, Waking Up. So needless to say, Sam, I'm a fan.
No, well, happy to hear it. Yeah, I'm glad you have found it all useful.
Something that I really admire about you, and a lot of people do, is that you do catch a lot of flack from left and right. A lot of people would say that that's a sign that you're doing something right. And I want to dig into the implications of that, for example, with identity, as well as talking about the illusory self, free will, meditation, and suffering. But where I want to actually start is with jujitsu, because I know, obviously, that's your sport of choice, as it were. And I wondered how you got into it, what are the benefits, and to what degree is it a metaphor for life, as far as you're concerned?
Well, in some ways, it's a metaphor for how life should be, and certainly how intellectual life should be, because jiu-jitsu is one of those rare martial arts where within its purview, there's really nothing left to chance, and there's no ability to bullshit yourself. I mean, there's nothing. So I don't know how much you know about martial arts, but you know, certainly most martial arts, most striking based martial arts that are not sports, you know, martial arts that are marketed as self defense platforms, they leave a lot to the imagination. I mean, what you get trained in is a kind of pantomime of violence. So you can just fool yourself for the longest time, and you know, hopefully there's no great consequence to that, because you'll manage to avoid violence your whole life. But in many scenarios, people are in for a rude awakening, and one rude awakening is to get on the mat with a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt and, you know, try to survive within the purview of that art, which is essentially wrestling and submissions, you know, leg locks, arm locks, chokes, things that bring the fight to the end without striking. So on the mat, wrestling with somebody who's great at jiu-jitsu, you quickly discover that the difference between knowing what to do and not knowing what to do is total. And there really is no possibility of getting lucky, right? It's not like you have the puncher's chance who if you happen to hit a professional boxer hard in the face, you know, who knows, you might knock him out. But with grappling, there really is just no scope for luck. I mean, you will lose 100 times out of 100 to someone who is fundamentally better than you. You learn in increments of, you know, maybe 20 minutes how you were fatally ignorant of something. I mean, so somebody literally kills you, you know, or it comes to the point where they could kill you and there's nothing you could do about it. I mean, someone is choking you and you tap out, and then you're resurrected, and you learn, you know, how that happened to you, how to stop it from happening to you, and how to do it to somebody else. And so there's this cycle of kind of catastrophe and reward that is utterly addictive.
Now, I've mentioned your Waking Up app, and obviously it's a, first and foremost, a meditation app, but meditation app with a difference in that it's set up to point in the direction of what meditation was, you could argue, initially set out to do. So with that in mind, when you talk about spirituality and your definition of it being seeing through the illusory self, which I want to dig into, but how could, if you were a sports psychologist, how could you bring that to the table to help someone compete in jiu-jitsu? Do you think it could be applied in a sporting sphere like that?
Well, jiu-jitsu is this amazingly ego nullifying experience. I mean, what you are confronted with again and again and again and again is the superior talent of those who are better than you, and how that is absolutely decisive. It's encouraging of a humility. There are other aspects to cutting through the illusion of the self. I mean, the deeper ones than this, but there really is an encounter with your ignorance that gets repeated again and again and again, no matter how much you learn. And it's immensely clarifying.
So if you have an inflated sense of self, jiu-jitsu is a good path to head down. Before we talk about the self and what it is and what it isn't, can you start by explaining really what the point of actual meditation is? And because obviously there's this perception, isn't there, that it's there to just simply to calm us down, to allow us to, you know, go into rest and digest. But actually, it's deeper than that.
Yeah, there are different levels at which to engage it. And so one can have different purposes certainly in the beginning. I would think most of the people who take it up have a general sense that they're not as happy as they might be. They're more stressed out than they want to be. They feel that they have a lack of focus on a moment to moment basis. And meditation is often offered to them in that context as a kind of remedy. You know, this will make you feel better on some level. And that's true. I mean, that can certainly be borne out by practice. It can be frustrating in the beginning because what you immediately come up against is just how distracted and distractible you are. You're spending all of your time having a conversation with yourself that you haven't really inspected before. So when you're asked to meditate, to pay attention to the breath or anything else, you immediately find this opposition between your intended focus and your natural proclivity for being lost in whatever next thought presents itself in consciousness. So, you know, you try to pay attention to the breath, and then 5 minutes later, you wake up realizing that you've just been thinking about your job or about your marriage or about something you saw on television for the last 5 minutes. And then, you know, again, it's like jujitsu in that sense. You're continually humbled by how out of control your mind is and how difficult it is to control it. But so many people adopt this project without any deeper aspirations than that. There's not a deeper contemplative or spiritual goal that they've set themselves, right? Meditation, you know, the Buddha 2,500 years ago did not recommend meditation merely as a way to de-stress or to add
get more focused,
capacity for your CEO toolkit. it's not really a self-improvement program. It is a self-understanding program, which ultimately terminates in your cutting through this illusion that you call yourself. There can be many misunderstandings here because we can mean many things by the term self. So I'll clarify that. But as you get deeper into it, you discover that really it's always about the difference between suffering and the end of suffering. And the punchline for that is that we suffer because we are identified with our thoughts. And that is what it is to feel like a self. Most people feel like there's a subject in the middle of experience. We feel like we're passengers in our bodies, you know, up in our heads, in some strange relationship to our own bodies, and even to parts of our own minds. I mean, we're having a conversation with ourselves as though we're not the one. We're not on both sides of the conversation. I mean, if you look at the structure of so much of your thinking, it is conversational in a way that doesn't make any sense. You'll say something to yourself as though you weren't the one to say it, right? And as though there's someone else in you who needed to hear it. And I mean, just a simple example, you know, in setting up for this podcast, if I'm looking for something on the desk, you know, let's say I'm looking for a pen, I might, upon spying the pen, I might actually think the thought, oh, there it is. Mm. Right? Who am I telling? I am the one to see the pen, right? So there's a false structure in here, which is peculiar, at least. And it's all predicated on this sense that there's a thinker in addition to thoughts themselves, and that there's a seer in addition to the experience of seeing. And there is just this subject-object dichotomy in seemingly every act of attention and perception and cognition. And the more you inspect that, I mean, meditation ultimately is the means by which you would pay more and more attention to that and discover that it is in fact an illusion. And that discovery is immensely freeing, right? It is the thing that unlocks a kind of tranquility that you would otherwise seek to produce. I mean, it's something that you may, in fact, if you could experience it all of a sudden and then lose it, you want to get back there. And people then try to get back there by meditating or taking psychedelics or, using other methods, doing yoga. But it's not best thought of as a peak experience. It's actually something that is intrinsic to the nature of awareness in each moment, and that can be recognized directly. And so the most sophisticated practices of meditation are really not practices at all. They're ways of having this insight into what is intrinsic to the nature of consciousness in each moment, and simply recognizing that again and again as a practice. But it's really not. It's really is just what it's like to no longer be distracted by thought in each moment.
So many thoughts popped up while you were saying all that. You've said having an ego is what it feels like to be thinking without knowing you're thinking. As you know, I spoke to Rupert Spira and I thoroughly enjoyed your conversation with him on your app. And he spoke about the separate self. And a lot of people were somewhat confused by that, just the very idea of a separate self, and another name for it could be the ego. And you said as well, then there isn't a thinker of the thought separate to the thoughts themselves. So if someone listening was to say, okay, that doesn't make sense to me, I can think up, I don't know, like a carrot, I can think up an image of a carrot right now, that's me thinking it, what would your riposte be to someone who's questioning this idea that they are not actually the thinker of their thoughts?
So we have an experience of self, and there are many facets to it, but the specific experience that I'm calling illusory is the sense that you are a subject in your head, a locus of attention and cognition in the head that can strategically pay attention to the breath, say. You're told to meditate, and I say, okay, well, the practice you're going to do now is you're going to pay attention to each breath as it comes and goes through your nostrils or the rising and falling of your chest. And you try to do that. You're now focusing on the sensation of breathing, and you feel like you're you in your head, the source of attention, aiming attention now at part of your body. And so this suggests a kind of duality where you don't feel identical to your body. You feel like you have a body and you're up in the head, a kind of passenger, but it is, when inspected, it's a false point of view from the first person side, subjectively. And you can see this. I mean, here's a logical way to appreciate that this might be so. If your experience of being a self is in fact experienced on any level, right? And it is, because if you're doubting whether what I'm saying makes any sense, you're doubting it by comparison with how you feel. You feel like, what's he talking about? I'm right here. I can think my thoughts. I just thought this one, and this is me in here. If that is experienced in any way, if that feels like anything, all of that whole constellation of experience has to be arising in consciousness. It has to be consciously experienced on some level. But by that very measure, consciousness cannot be merely identical to it. I mean, it must be prior to, it must be the prior condition of its appearing. It just as anything else you can notice is an object for consciousness. So that the sound of my voice, I mean, because you can hear it, you as consciousness are not identical to it. And so it is with your own hand. You look down at your hand, it's an object for you. It's arising as a constellation of sensations and appearances, visual and tactile in consciousness at this moment. Consciousness is the prior condition of its appearance. Well, what you're calling self, if it has any signature at all, if it's there to be noticed at all, it's appearing in this prior condition, which can't be merely reducible to it or confined by it. If you do keep dropping back into the point of view of merely recognizing that awareness is the space in which everything's appearing, and everything includes thoughts and this feeling of being a subject, you can begin to notice that consciousness itself doesn't actually feel identical to any of those things. Ultimately, you recognize that there's simply consciousness and its contents. All you experience is this open condition in which things arise all on their own. And among those things are your thoughts and intentions and counter-intentions and counter-thoughts, right? So you could sit for an hour trying to figure out whether you want to lift your right hand or your left hand. You can go back and forth between them. But the final thought or intention that proves effective simply arises, right? You as the conscious witness are not in a position to know why it won out over any other in that moment. And so it is too with, you know, your example. Look, I can think of a carrot right now. Well, there's no place from which you as a conscious witness of your experience picked carrot. Carrot simply appeared, and you are in no position to know why you didn't pick a bicycle, right? You just didn't think of a bicycle. It's our identification with thought, our feeling, our not noticing thoughts as mere appearances in consciousness that makes us feel like an ego or a thinker or the center in this kind of the center of narrative gravity in the middle of what is in fact just this open and inscrutable condition where everything simply appears all by itself.
Yeah. Okay, just to recap a couple of bits then. So if we think of a carrot, it's only after the event that we have another thought that goes back and thinks, oh, I chose that thought of the carrot, when actually it was the carrot itself just popping up and then we claiming it later.
Yeah, well, I would put it slightly differently. The feeling of thinking of a carrot when you don't recognize thoughts as appearances in consciousness, you're not seeing the thought before you feel identical to it. The feeling that you did it is what it's like to not notice a thought as a thought. It kind of sneaks up behind you and just feels like you, right? Which in itself should seem peculiar. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, how could the voice in your head, the voice of your mind, how could these stray pieces of language or images be what you are? I mean, how could you mistake that for yourself? You know, I'm talking now and just notice how this competes. I'm now talking to our audience. Notice how this competes for your attention. You know, you're trying to listen to what I'm saying, but I am competing with a voice in your head, which is very likely distracting you moment by moment, because I'm talking, but you're also talking to yourself, saying things like, "Well, what's he talking? Get to the point, man. What's he talking?" And that feels like you, but how is it? How could that feel like you? I mean, it really is. And this kind of automaticity of language production, and it's if you notice it as it is, it's rather like my voice in that it just appears and then disappears, and you can't hold on to it for each thought comes and goes, and you can't hold on to it for a moment longer than it persists on its own. They're kind of like sounds in a way, yet uninspected, it feels like me. And it feels like a condition of control of experience. Like I'm in charge here. I'm pulling the levers and working the gears of my own experience. And yet the truth is no one knows what they will think next. And you can make this as constrained as you want, and you still don't know what you'll think next. So I mean, I can give you the task of just remember something, Just remember anything from your life, any moment from the past, just summon a memory. Now, if you do that, do that a few times and pay attention to what that's like and in what sense are you actually responsible? You, the one who, you know, receives the memory, in what sense are you responsible for the memory that surfaces, right? I ask you to go fishing for memories and you throw the line out and you have no idea what you'll get back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like looking through a CD rack and picking one out individually. And you talked about consciousness in terms of it being open, aware space. And another way to describe it could just be the simple fact of being aware. And as you've pointed out, everything arises in our awareness. So the thoughts we think, thoughts arise in consciousness, but also sensations arise in consciousness. My bottom on the seat right now, and perceptions arise in consciousness. So what I can see and smell and taste and everything like that, feelings and emotions. So everything arises in consciousness and they all have objective qualities and they come and go, but the awareness itself, it doesn't come and go, but we're so used to putting our attention on the contents of consciousness, the objects of consciousness, whether that be thoughts or what we see or whatever, any of those things, that it's so easy to overlook that sort of simple fact of being aware and consciousness. And what comes to mind now for me really is the story of you when you were in Colorado, when you were like 18 or 19 and spent 3 days on your own, you know, in solitude and basically tormenting yourselves with imaginings about objects. And that seemed to be a very formative thing. But yeah, could you just speak about how easy it is to overlook this awareness that is fundamental really to everything that we experience and what the significance of that is?
So the experience you referred to, I was 16 and on this this wilderness course called Outward Bound, which I'm pretty sure still exists in the US. I don't know if they're in the UK or anywhere else, but and it was a 23-day backpacking trip in Colorado, which culminates with something they called the Solo, where you would fast for 3 days in solitude, right? So you just had your tent and your journal and nothing else. I mean, no books and no distractions, and you couldn't go off exploring. You just had to stay put. In this case, we were by this beautiful Alpine Lake. We're up at like 11,000 feet, and just in, you know, objectively one of the most beautiful corners of the world. And you know, I was healthy. I had just spent 18 days trekking through the mountains of Colorado, and I certainly deserved a rest. And you know, it may sound like a hardship to fast and, you know, drink nothing but water for 3 days. You know, that's physically speaking, that's not such a difficult thing to do. So this was a circumstance where many things could have happened for me. I could have discovered my deep love of nature. I mean, I'm looking up at the sky at night and seeing more stars than I'd ever have in my life. And, you know, it could have been a circumstance of just pure pleasure. And yet I was absolutely miserable. You know, I was as one being tortured by his own mind. You know, deeply lonely, missing everyone in my life, making lists of the foods I planned to eat when I got back to civilization, just plunged into a state of total unhappiness, just minute by minute, hour by hour for 3 solid days. And I had absolutely no sense that my own mind was the problem. And then I came off the Solo, and everyone else on this trip was considerably older than I was. I mean, most of the people were kind of in their mid-20s. And this experience for them landed totally differently. I mean, I'm sure some of them had been unhappy for periods of time, but many of them had a transformative experience and were just radiantly happy. And when I saw that, I mean, that was the first inkling I had that, okay, wait a minute, maybe there's something I don't understand about what's possible here and about what I should expect of myself and my life and my own mind. And I mean, that was a seed that didn't really germinate for a few more years. That was a necessary first glimpse of my own capacity to be miserable. And most of us manage to arrange our lives so that we don't have to notice that, right? I mean, now in the age of the smartphone, most of us never experience boredom. I mean, I don't know the last time I've ever been in a situation where I could possibly come up against my own capacity for boredom because of the technological prosthesis I have now with this smartphone or an iPad always available. I mean, and the sum total of all of human knowledge and increasingly all of human entertainment available with almost no friction. So it used to be that boredom could have been a goad to self-inquiry for virtually every generation of humanity prior to this one. That was true. I mean, there was always a moment where you're sitting in the waiting room of your dentist and confronted with a stack of terrible magazines and just forced into the company of your own thoughts for 20 minutes. And many of us in those moments were forced to recognize, okay, it's something peculiar about feeling this destabilized by not having one's attention diverted by some entertainment, right? Like, how is it that I'm not content to merely sit in the company of my thoughts for 20 minutes? And that's an experience that almost no one has anymore. And when it's forced on you for one reason or another, as it was for me in the mountains when I was 16, and you have days to confront it, you know, unless you have a framework in which to think about that as a real opportunity to deepen your awareness of profound truths about the nature of your own mind, which is to say, unless you're a contemplative of some kind or poised to be one, it's very common to find that experience just lacerating. And it's why solitary confinement is considered a torture inside a prison. I mean, this is just an amazing fact about the human mind. We're so deeply social that most of us would prefer to live in the company of murderers and rapists than to live alone in a box by ourselves, because boredom and solitude and monotony are that terrifying. And what's terrifying there is what an untrained mind is like in those conditions. Because a trained mind in those conditions can just produce a circumstance of bliss. You know, I mean, this is the condition that real contemplatives have sought out for thousands of years. You know, one of my teachers spent 20 years in a cave. So it's possible to completely flip the script there and to find solitude a wellspring of profound engagement with the nature of reality, at least first person reality.
So lots of people aren't going to have that much time on their hands to go and sit in a cave. And I mean, earlier you talked about understanding that we are not our thoughts and being able to see that the ego is an illusion, but it takes time to establish into that. But when you're meditating, for example, and you notice, oh, I'm thinking about, you mentioned, you know, what was on TV or whatever it may be, my marriage, whatever. At that moment, when you disidentify with the thought, just perhaps in that split second or even shorter time than that, between that thought ending and another one coming up, at that, well, it's not really a moment, is it, in time, but that's when you're dropping into consciousness. So even though perhaps, you know, getting stabilized in that might take a long time, actually, this is an experience, albeit one that is easy to overlook, that everyone has, the experience of being aware and not lost in thought. We do drop into that fairly regularly, isn't it?
Well, it's an interesting question. So everyone has the experience of consciousness because that is the only that is synonymous with experience itself. So what I mean by consciousness is just the fact that it's like something to be what you are. You are, as a matter of experience, are consciousness and its contents, right? I mean, and this extends to everything you can notice, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, your emotions, you know, various senses that you're not, you don't tend to think about, like proprioception. I mean, anything that has a signature of change in your sense of you know, what you are in the world. Everything that defines the qualitative character of what it's like to be you in this moment, that's what I mean by consciousness. And the question is whether there is a self in the middle of that or not, right? Now, it seems like there is one. Most people feel like it's me over here behind my face, looking into my experience, looking into my visual field, feeling down in my body as though from a place up in the head. And meditation is a technique of ultimately of inspecting that starting point closely enough so that you see it suddenly very differently, and consciousness resolves itself into this single, groundless, open, and intrinsically free condition. And what is it free of? Well, it's free of this feeling of I or me in the middle, but it's also free of feeling entangled by specific thoughts and emotions that are arising in each moment. So you can recognize, you know, a thought that would otherwise capture you completely and make you feel miserable. You know, your thought of that embarrassing thing you said at the party last night that you wish you hadn't said that, right? God, how, what kind of idiot are you that you would say such a thing? And did you see the look on her face when you said, and all of those are thoughts, right? And they're completely empty of implication until you identify with them. And recognizing them as just this bad movie that is playing again and again and again to an audience of one, or presumably an audience of one, you can step back and be genuinely free of what you would otherwise be totally subsumed by, which is this cascade of negative emotion that's being kindled in every moment as you identify with each crappy thought that comes careening into your conscious mind. So that ability to fundamentally step out of that condition of identification with thought and emotion and recognize the free and open context in which any thoughts or emotions are appearing, that's what meditation ultimately is. And it does become a kind of superpower. But as you say, people do experience this in miniature, even when they're not, you know, when they've never taken an interest in meditation and they've never even heard of the concept. Yeah, I think people are continually losing their sense of self and not recognizing it. I mean, you can get lost in your work, or you can get distracted by a movie. You can get so into the movie that you forget you're watching a movie, right? You're just the moments where movies really work for us are moments where we have forgotten that we're sitting in a darkened room looking at light on the wall, and we're completely fixated on what's happening on the screen. But it is different to have a flow experience, say, where, you know, you're surfing and, you know, these moments where it's really going well and you've caught, you know, the perfect wave where you just feel like it's just you and the universe, and the boundary between you and the world or you and the wave isn't even so clear, right? It's just you're not doing it anymore. You're no longer looking over your own shoulder. You're really just having a unified experience of so-called flow.
Yeah, I've spoken about this, you know, where Johnny Wilkinson, when he kicked the winning drop goal with a very famous moment here in England, through to Frankie Dettori. I mean, I've got lots of anecdotal evidence of people coming on here talking about that, the flow, and the research suggests that obviously you get that distortion of time and the loss of that sense of being me. So in terms of how you describe consciousness, and I've heard you say this before, is, you know, something that it's like to be something. And for me, an almost simpler way of putting it that I understand, that I get, is just the simple fact of being aware. Now, I know, for example, that you spoke to Adyashanti as well, and he speaks about the more that you put your attention on something, the more it grows into the foreground of experience. And so he talks about being increasingly aware of awareness, being aware of being aware. And that's something I think that for me has been quite powerful, in that sometimes it would just be like, oh, wow, you know, there's awareness fundamental to everything objective that I experience. And I've meditated pretty consistently. I mean, nowhere near like you. But as well, there's, for example, acceptance and commitment therapy. And I quite like one of their techniques, which is just, you know, when you notice you're lost in thought, just to go do a diffusion technique, which might just be something like, oh, I'm aware of the thought that X, you know, I'm going to get sacked or whatever it may be. And then you sort of drop back into awareness. And so we have, and I know you speak about, we've got the experiencing self, and then let's say the remembering self. So the self that exists in time, future and past, and then the experiencing self, which is that part of you or the listener that can hear my voice now. And the more we identify with the storied part of us, so that part that you mentioned that's cursing their luck for a social faux pas at the party last night, the more we identify with that, which is just born of thought, that equates a lot with suffering. There's that famous saying, isn't there? You know, that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. So we may stub our toe, but it's the narrative that we form around that. Oh, that shouldn't have happened. Goodness, I'm not going to be able to play football tomorrow, whatever it may be. And that's where the suffering comes in. So to what degree do you agree with this? The more that we're able to identify with that part of us that is simply aware, in which the thoughts and the stories come and go as they will, and there's nothing we can, you know, that's just going to happen. That's part of being human. But the more that we can identify with that part of us that is aware, the less likely we are to suffer.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it in terms of identifying with awareness, because in the end, identification with anything is the obstacle to recognizing the intrinsic freedom of awareness or consciousness. I'm using those terms interchangeably.
So you wouldn't say it is who, you know, like us at our core level?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, in one sense you could say that, but it's, that suggests a kind of identification with the witness as a, you know, as opposed to anything else, which is itself a kind of, you know, uninspected
dualistic
thought, yeah, or concept, right? So ultimately, the concept that really captures this best, although it really does require a fair amount of explanation in translation, is the Buddhist concept of emptiness. Now, you know, emptiness doesn't sound very good to the ear in English. It sounds like, you know, why would I want to discover the intrinsic emptiness of everything? That sounds depressing. That sounds like it robs life of meaning. It certainly doesn't sound like a basis for joy, much less bliss. But emptiness, when you get into what is the details of what is meant by that within Buddhism, it does capture this non-identification piece better than other traditionally mystical framings. I mean, there's a difference between centerlessness or groundlessness and oneness, right? If you're aiming for oneness, that becomes a kind of reification of what's left when you're no longer identified with thought. It's a kind of a thought-based way of grabbing everything. And it's, I think it is misleading. I mean, it can be, you know, it could be stylistically just a matter of taste in certain cases, how one describes this, whether one emphasizes the what it isn't as opposed to what it is. But in terms of what it ultimately is, from my point of view, it's not identifying with anything.
Yeah.
Right? It's just what's left when you're no longer grasping at experience or resisting, you know, grasping at what's pleasant or resisting what's unpleasant or not noticing what is neutral. Yeah. Right? It's just open, centerless clarity that allows anything in principle to appear. You're not blocking half of your experience. You're not saying, I don't want to think that. I don't want to feel that. It's not a kind of strategy of resistance. In fact, you're willing to feel anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And feel it totally. I mean, so it's not mind. If you're trying to change your experience, you know, if you feel anxious and then you start being mindful of anxiety, you just pay close attention to the feeling of anxiety and you notice your thoughts that are making you anxious and you let go of those and you come back to the feeling, the raw feeling of just the physiology of being adrenalized in that way. The only way to actually be mindful of anxiety in this case is to truly accept it and to be deeply willing to feel it. I mean, to feel it with genuine openness and curiosity and compassion, but it can't be a strategy to get rid of it, no. Right? So, and that's the trap that people immediately fall into. It's like they're being mindful so that the anxiety will go away.
Yeah.
Done in that way, it's just a practice of self-deception. So the first insight with mindfulness is to be willing to feel anxiety and to be willing to burn up with it. I mean, just let yourself become incandescently anxious and recognize that awareness itself never truly takes the form of anxiety. It's a, you know, that which is aware of anxiety is precisely the same thing that's aware of joy or any other emotion. Mm. And you can keep dropping back into that merely witnessing frame of mind that allows everything to just arise and change and pass away. And then if you can do that and you actually get out of the thoughts about, you know, why you should feel anxious, you'll notice that anxiety has a very short half-life, and so does anger and any other negative emotion. And they dissipate very, very quickly. And so, you know, again, that's a knot you have to keep untying.
So that's the paradox. But that's just to jump in quick, Sam, isn't it? That is the paradox, isn't it? That you spoke about emptiness, so no identification there. But that emptiness, you know, it's still an aware emptiness, isn't it?
But it can't say yes or no
to anything. That's its nature, isn't it? It can't say, I like and don't like this experience. So therefore, like saying yes to any experience, anxiety, fear, whatever it may be, not as a way to get rid of it, but that is the very nature of it, is accepting everything.
Yeah. But if you're still left feeling like the meditator or feeling like the one who's doing that, there's something left uninspected here. And that is, that does come back to this ground truth that consciousness itself, you know, that which is aware of anything you can be aware of doesn't feel like me.
No.
It doesn't feel like and whatever feels like me is something that is an appearance in consciousness.
Yeah. Well, it's not personal. A lot of people talk about the difference between like personal awareness and impersonal awareness as well. But before, I mean, I did want to talk to you a bit about suffering in particular, because I think, you know, a lot of people do suffer unnecessarily. And that is born of the stories that they tell themselves, often about themselves, perhaps born of misperceptions, you know, when they were kids or whatever it may be, or, you know, stories about what's happened, like you said, at the party last night, I shouldn't have said that. Or so for people who, as so many of us are wont to do, who torment ourselves with the stories and the thoughts and identifying with them, beyond simply developing a solid meditation practice, what would you say to someone who is prone to tormenting themselves in that way, as so many are?
The first thing to say is that this is almost universally true. 99.99% of us are suffering unnecessarily a lot of the time, and this is always a story of being identified with thoughts that are making us unhappy. And this is pointless suffering. I'm not saying that all pain is unnecessary or avoidable, and even all suffering is avoidable, but so much of it is obviously not equipping us to do anything better. In fact, it's degrading our capacity to do anything useful. So, I mean, to take a concrete example, you know, you could get a scary medical diagnosis, say, right? You know, one doctor says he doesn't like what, we see on this X-ray and thinks it might be cancer and it's, you know, time to get a biopsy. And so now you're worried about, now you suddenly, you know, the day before you were not thinking that cancer was something you had to worry about anytime soon, if ever. But now you are right on the cusp of a horrible adventure in medicine, or so it seems. A cancer diagnosis is, you know, very likely in the offing, right? And now you're terrifically worried by all that. And you've got your, you know, biopsy appointment coming in 4 days, right? So what's life going to be like in your brain for the next 4 days? How much of your worrying is useful at this point? I mean, you've made the appointment for 4 days from now. What's left to think about? Is there anything left to think about at this point? And so much of our lives are lived in these interim conditions where there's something that worries us. And yet there's no longer anything left to think about because we have decided to take the next action that is relevant to solving our problem. In this case, you've scheduled the medical procedure 4 days hence. This could be, you know, to take it out of the medical zone for a second. I mean, this could be, you know, something, some presentation you have to make, you know, a week from now that you're very nervous about, right? And you've prepared for it, you know, and you're preparing for it. You've decided to prepare for it. You will prepare for it. But in addition to preparing, you're just worried about it, right? 99% of our thinking about the future is totally pointless. It's not actually allowing us to decide to do anything differently. We're not correcting course in any meaningful way. We're just immiserating ourselves by thinking, again, without knowing that we're thinking. I mean, you might have an abstract idea that you're thinking. You might be able to say, of course, I know I'm thinking when asked. But moment by moment, there you are being dragged onto a dreamscape of suffering that is completely unnecessary. It really is analogous to being asleep and dreaming and not knowing that you're dreaming. And so whether you call it meditation or not, it's important to acknowledge that most of our thinking about our lives is not the same as the actual character of the experiences we have when those moments we're thinking about actually come to be real in the present, right? So your thought about your biopsy in 4 days isn't your biopsy in 4 days, right? It's a thought that's arising now. I mean, when your biopsy finally arrives, that experience will be what it will be, right? And it'll be however long it'll be, and however painful it'll be. But all of your thinking about it up until it actually happens serves very likely no other purpose than to make you unhappy until it happens. And we go from one moment like that in our lives, good and bad. And we have, you know, the goals we want to reach and the vacations we want to take. And, you know, all of these, we have all these landmarks on the apparent, you know, horizon, but the experience of reaching them is almost uniformly the experience of arriving at a kind of mirage where it's like whatever the character of the experience, good or bad, it recedes and we find ourselves incapable of truly making contact with it because we have the kind of minds that are always looking over the shoulder of the present moment at the next thing that's coming, you know, a moment later, a minute later, an hour later, or next year, right? We're constantly leaning into the future and very rarely making, you know, full collision contact with the present. And again, we have these moments of flow or these moments of, you know, peak experience, but we misattribute the causality there to the conditions in the world that conspired to make those moments unavoidable, right? So again, if you're somebody for whom surfing is your gateway to flow, well then you'll think that the only way to have this flow experience is to get up at the crack of dawn and get your wetsuit on and get out into the water and catch the right wave. And if there are no great waves that day, you'll be disappointed, right? But what meditation teaches you is that you can have this experience on demand simply by paying closer attention to the nature of any experience, good or bad.
Yeah. So the hint of that then is, you know, flow is there the whole time, hidden in plain sight. It's just a mm-hmm. question of whether or not we can get to it. I mean, that's pretty clumsy language, but if you get what I mean. I spoke a little earlier about identifying with awareness, taking the stand, if you like, as awareness, as opposed to the story. So the story of me, which is a big part of the ego, the, you know, our history, our likes and dislikes, our, you know, whether we think we're great or, you know, unlovable, whatever it may be. I've heard you talk about it's very easy, actually, to rewrite that story, to come up with a new one. But, you know, I was thinking, what about really holding any story really loosely? Because, I, for example, one day I might think that I'm a look after a six-year-old really well. And then the next day I might be like, goodness, I'm not that good at this actually at all. You know, the same situation or roughly the same situation can, depending on our mood and various other factors, can provoke a completely different interpretation. So just to go off on a bit of a tangent then, obviously identity is such a big thing right now. And you know, something I admire, I think, about you is what you talk about in terms of identity politics. And let's say if you're right wing in America, you're likely to, you know, support gun, you know, you're pro-guns, put it simply. You're pro-life. It's very common that you will fall in line with the beliefs associated with the right way of looking at the world, and same on the left. And so as someone who doesn't do that, who does tend to look at each case on a case-by-case basis, which to me is the sane approach to anything, what's your take on the fact that identity right now is such a big thing in various forms? You know, and I actually started my whole podcast series on this, you know, about the tribalism in football in this country. But then obviously we've had Brexit, you've had, you know, I know things are crazy in terms of Republicans and Democrats, and it's so heightened right now. What's your take on identity, just generally speaking, and how desperate people are to have one, firstly? And do you think this is the last flourish of heightened identity politics and all that kind of stuff? Or is it a trend that's only going to continue? And obviously, this is following on from the self chat that we're talking about, because it is related, right?
Yeah, no, all of these things are related. There are several threads here that are worth distinguishing. I mean, there is, it's undeniable that stories and concepts have real power, and that you really can play on both levels as someone who's living a more and more examined life, right? So, you know, the remedy for any specific problem could be mindfulness. I mean, and mindfulness does go deep enough so that, you know, I would say that yes, you can find that you're free no matter what is happening if you just pay sufficient attention, not, you know, ultimately non-conceptual attention to the nature of consciousness. But that freedom isn't the same thing as having some new capacity that you actually wanted to have, right? That would allow you to function differently in the world. So if you don't know how to ride a bicycle or hit a golf ball before you become a Buddha, well, you won't know how to do those things after you become a Buddha, right? I mean, you might not care, but you know, you still are, you know, it's not like having a profound insight into emptiness is going to make you great at any specific thing that, you know, it might not be nice to be great at. So, you know, if there are things you actually want to do and change about yourself or your life, you know, there's no substitute for actually getting the conceptual tools in hand to do those things. And some of that could be a matter of telling yourself a better story, right? And thinking of yourself in different ways and noticing kind of, and in a way that's not esoteric at all, getting some better coaching from outside and from inside to perform differently. And some of this relates to the kind of the stage at life in life one is. So, you know, much of what I would demand of myself or consider normative in myself now is not what I would recommend to one of my daughters. You know, either my daughters are 12 and 7, and you know, in the context of who they are now, I regularly encourage them to see themselves in ways that I'd no longer see myself, and wouldn't think it would be optimal for me to see myself in those ways. So, you know, I love it when one of my daughters feels proud to have accomplished something. That is part of their, you know, the toolkit of you know, increasing competence and, you know, self-actualization that they need to acquire at this point in life. Mm-hmm. But in my life now, you know, pride has absolutely no application to anything I'm doing. It just shows up as pure delusion for me to feel proud about anything. Virtually never happens, and I don't miss it at all. I mean, it's a tiny emotion. It's just the most boring thing in the world to compare yourself favorably to somebody else.
That's the problem I have with self-esteem, just to jump in there quickly. You know, I think self-esteem, it's about comparing. It's ranking, isn't it? And it comes back to that, the story you have about yourself, rather than, say, for example, self-acceptance, which I quite like in terms of the emptiness and the awareness. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, Sam. Carry on.
Yeah. I mean, it's a close cousin of something that you do want, which is you want to feel competent.
Yes.
You want to be able to do what you want to do. You don't want to feel perpetually frustrated or stifled or self-sabotaging or just cycling around, you know, some condition of inaction because you just can't figure out how to get started or how to reach any of your goals. I mean, all of that, there's a type of unhappiness that gets, you know, accreted around those various sticking points to which self-esteem or self-actualization or self-confidence or pride or, you know, all of that can seem like the antidote. At bottom, the antidote is just very simple. There are things each of us needs to learn in order to accomplish specific things in life. But, you know, ultimately, the better you get at anything, the less and less it makes any sense at all to feel proud or embarrassed or humiliated or any of the oppositely valenced emotions. It's just, there's just a continuous string of successes and failures and refinements and course corrections.
Yeah.
And at bottom, no one is doing it right. It's like it really is mysterious how you go from zero to mastery of anything. And at no point along the way can you really own the process. And it, especially at the level of mastery, I mean, mastery is associated with less and less awareness of how you're doing anything.
It comes back to like flow, for example. You know, when someone is really exceptionally good at something, it's automatic and they're really out of the way and just letting it happen.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of practice, the whole point of learning all of the distinctions you need to learn in order to get truly good at something is ultimately to learn it so well that you have no idea how you do anything. Mm. You just do it.
I just wanted to ask you about identity then, for a bit of clarity.
Sorry, I completely missed your identity politics overture. Yeah,
that's all right. That's okay. Yeah. But just to come back to it, you know, what do you make of how tightly people are clinging to identity, what's your answer to it? What's your take on all of that stuff?
Well, this is what I meant. So, in starting out and talking about the appropriateness of various things at different stages in life.
Yes. So it's immature. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it is a kind of regression to the childhood of our species or the childhood of culture. And in that sense, it's not good at all as a basis for politics. And it's so obviously not good as a durable basis for politics because it's this emphasis on identity is explicitly closing the door to real compromise, real communication, a real mutually benefiting open-ended collaboration between the various subgroups, right? I'm like, if you can't possibly understand me and my precious experience because you haven't shared my precious experience, well, then there's not much to talk about, right? It's like, it's not, you know, if you because of who you are, because of your religion or you're the color of your skin or the your biological sex or whatever,
football team,
superficial quality, you know, I'm going to anchor you to, if you can't, if you have no standing to judge the merits of my ideas, because my ideas issue from this private place of epistemological gravitas, my own privileged experience, that applies to a few things in life, like, you know, journal entries and, you know, whether I love my spouse or it's not you for you to judge that. But when we're talking about politics and about trying to, which is, requires that we converge on common
consensus
judgments about what's real in the world and what is worth doing, it's a disaster. I mean, it's just the absolute antithesis of what you want running on the hard drive in order to have a sane conversation about anything that relates to the common good. And I mean, the place where it relates to meditation and everything else we've been talking about very directly is, you know, I've been saying, you know, here that you don't have to identify with your own thoughts, right? You don't have to identify with your own, with the face you see in the mirror each day. And in fact, real insight into the nature of your mind and, you know, real wisdom and real compassion ultimately will require that you don't identify with those things. What will require that you penetrate your own experience closely enough so that you recognize that identification with the face you see in the mirror is in the end impossible. Well, how much less need you identify with random strangers out there who just happen to share some superficial characteristic with the face you see in the mirror? I mean, how much, if I don't have to identify with my own body in the end, why would I have to identify with being a white man, right? And be unable to identify with someone else's background that I don't share, or unable to fuse my values and my cognitive horizons with people from another subgroup? It's just a crazy, and again, childish starting point in the end. And it should be clear to us that we want to get to a world where the superficial differences between people, like skin color, to take race as perhaps the most charged variable here, are no more important politically or morally than differences in hair color, say, or eye color, right? I mean, no one cares about differences in hair color or eye color. And there's no one who's disposed to look to see if Google or Apple or British Airways or any other corporation has hired enough green-eyed people, right? Or whether the representation of blonde-haired people in those organizations perfectly mirrors the representation of blonde-haired people in wider society, right? And upon discovering that it doesn't, let's say we discover that Apple has only, you know, 17% blonde-haired people, whereas 21% of people are in fact blonde, so that, you know, 4% differential, I'm just making these percentages up, I don't know what the real percentages are, but any difference there must suggest an animus against blondes, right? This is the consequences of bigotry, right? You know, you would have to be insane to think such a thing now, right? At any point about hair color. And yet it is routine to imagine this is true with respect to race and gender and religion and many other things to which, you know, people are identified. And it's not, it's obviously it's not a mystery as to how we got here. I mean, we do, you know, we are trailing an impressive legacy of racism and sexism, in particular, in you know, in every society. But to not acknowledge how much progress we've made on those fronts, you know, is destabilizing and dishonest and ultimately obscene. So we have made tremendous progress, and I think continued progress, you know, there's certainly more to make, but continued progress will be a matter of caring less and less about those differences between people. It can't be a matter of caring more and more about them.
It's quite exciting, I think, to see, for example, you know, your app, which is talking very openly and clearly about the illusion of the ego. And just this is becoming so much more of a common topic. I was really proud to get it. I shouldn't say proud, but I was to get it, you know, talk about non-duality on the BBC, which was, I think, a bit of a first. And, you know, these kind of conversations are happening more and more and more. And it'd be nice, I think, to think that if that trend continued, then this need to cling to identity in whatever form might loosen, you know. And it's more like, yes, we all have roles to play, but we can hold them a bit more loosely than perhaps we are now. And, you know, I always just come back to football in this country, which is, you know, very tribal and very charged. You know, I always remember being on a high street and trying to find Tottenham fans. So Tottenham and Arsenal, they can't stand each other. I'm not sure if you know of the North London rivalry. And I spoke to a guy and his son, and he just started effing and blinding about Arsenal fans in general. And it was, to me, it was, you know, the definition of insanity. Anyway, listen, I'm slightly conscious that we haven't got a lot of time left, Sam. So I want to ask you something, which is around, you know, how you've grown, developed your opinions. You know, perhaps I wonder to what degree they have changed or not. Because, so your book, Waking Up, it came out, what was that, 2014? Did it come out?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So it came out 2014. So I'm interested to what degree you've been influenced by conversations you have had, for example, with Adyashanti or someone like Rupert Spira as well, both of which, may I say, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. Because Adyashanti, if someone asked him, or I've heard someone ask him, do you think the awareness in him is the same as it is in you and I, he says yes. He believes the awareness is the same. It's the same impersonal awareness. Rupert Spira, as you know, believes that it is primary, let's say, to everything, not just our thoughts and everything like that. It's to even the buildings I see out of my window right now, consciousness is primary to that, for example. Now, in your book, Waking Up, on page 53, it says, whatever the ultimate relationship between consciousness and matter, almost everyone will agree that at some point in the development of complex organisms like ourselves, consciousness seems to emerge. You know, it seems even since then, in 2014, I would assert that there has been a rise in the number of people, or perhaps the number of conversations around suggesting that actually, no, let's go back to, you know, the Max Planck view of things, that perhaps consciousness is fundamental, and actually matter, all matter, seems to arise in consciousness and awareness. You know, and people like Adyashanti and Rupert Spira, as far as I can see, assert that. But now you have as well someone like, who I'm sure you're very familiar with, Bernardo Kastrup, who is, you know, a scientist of the very, very top order. And he says, yes, as far as he's concerned, and he's had things published in very highly esteemed scientific publications, saying that no, everything is consciousness and it's just taking various forms. And I just wonder to what degree, perhaps, have you been influenced at all by these conversations and this outlook, or are you still steadfast in your view that it must be an emergent property of matter?
You know, I'm just taking a very conservative, actually agnostic position with respect to the status of consciousness here. And it's, what I really want to distinguish, you know, across the board, not on just this topic, but on anything I talk about, are gradations of certainty. I mean, I want to be able to say the thing that is clearly true And then there are things that occupy a real gray area. And then there are things that are not only is it clear we don't know one way or the other, but it's not even clear that we can know. And I try to be very scrupulous around differentiating those different zones. And so, for instance, it is obvious to me that consciousness is the only thing we ever directly experience. I mean, this is almost tautological. I mean, it is experience itself, right? And therefore, you know, one cannot say, as certain, you know, very esteemed scientists and philosophers have, that consciousness might be an illusion, right? Yeah. Consciousness is the one thing in this universe that cannot be an illusion.
Yeah.
Full stop, right? There is, in fact, nothing to debate here, because if there's any illusion present, if I could be completely confused about what reality is and where I am with respect to it. And I mean, this could all be a dream, right?
Of course.
Or I could be a simulation on the hard drive of some alien supercomputer, or this is the Matrix, you know, all of that's conceivable. But the presence of illusion is just as much proof of the reality of consciousness as any real experience would be, right? So just in my world, you know, consciousness simply cannot be an illusion. But to move from that direct access to this kind of primacy of consciousness, to make a further metaphysical claim about what that means in terms of neuroscience or in terms of physics, there are many steps there that we need not take, and there are certain steps that we cannot take, or that if taken badly, put you into obviously fringe territory with respect to those specific sciences, right? So there are people who will say, well, no, this is this experience of the primacy of consciousness. This proves that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics was right all along. And, you know, consciousness is the necessary ingredient for the collapse of the wave function. There are people who think that, but those are not people who are influential in physics anymore and haven't been for about 75 years. Virtually all of the great physicists of our own time will have very little patience for a mere, you know, quasi-mystical reassertion of the significance of consciousness for quantum mechanics these days, right? And so from my point of view, there's just no reason to do it, and nothing necessary from the contemplative side. Nothing necessary is added if you pretend to know that consciousness was, you know, existed prior to the Big Bang. Say,
can I just hop in quickly, Sam?
Yeah,
just, you used the word agnostic, which I think is the sensible position to take. Again, just looking at your book, so instead, the birth of consciousness must be the result of organization. So it does sound to me like you have
I don't think I'm saying that. I think if you go back and look, okay. I'm talking about what most people in neuroscience believe, right?
Sorry, my question really was then about, but because it's like, okay, people assert that, for example, consciousness existed before the Big Bang. At the same time, people are asserting that consciousness is an emergent property of brain, and there's no evidence for that either. So surely both of them must be treated exactly the same, no?
No, not quite, because so there's abundant evidence that what we call mind is an emergent property of information processing.
Really?
In our case, in biological brains, but you know, in the case of AI, this is happening in a very different substrate. We know what we mean by intelligence in various contexts, and we know what we mean by other, you know, faculties of mind. We know what, you know, visual perception is. We know what cognitive, you know, control of behavior is.
We don't know what consciousness is, though.
Well, so consciousness is its own piece, which is still genuinely mysterious in terms of how it relates to information processing, but everything else is an emergent property of organization.
But isn't that all the content of consciousness rather than consciousness itself? So we're back to the difference between the content and the context.
Well, you know, so I remain agnostic as to, you know, what consciousness is at bottom. And perhaps it does, perhaps it in the end, it will seem like it is another fundamental constituent of matter that goes all the way down to the, you know, to the atomic level or the subatomic level, right? So that maybe something like panpsychism is true, or, you know, flipping it in the other direction, maybe something like idealism is true.
Bernardo Kastrup take on things, right? That the only consciousness exists and everything, and it just takes the form of many things. So you are a bit more agnostic that may be, that's not definitively wrong.
Well, it's not wrong, but the way people try to justify their conviction for this view in many cases is obviously wrong.
Okay, but just as a real short one then, Sam. Am I right in saying you are more agnostic now than you were in 2014 or in 2010?
No,
memory
serves, I could be wrong, but I think I was just as agnostic then. I think the thing that I was saying, you know, for sometimes several pages at a stretch, is that you are certainly not going to embarrass yourself in a scientific discussion now if you think that virtually everything about us, including consciousness, is an emergent property of information processing in the brain. And and you're on very firm ground saying that for everything that relates to our functional capacities as minds, but you really can't say that with any certainty on the point of consciousness. And that making that distinction was what I was wanting to make. But it's genuinely mysterious what the relationship is, and therefore it will be mysterious when we build AI that passes the Turing test, you know, so that when we find ourselves in relationship to robots and computers that are as intelligent and insightful as we are, if we haven't figured out how consciousness relates to information processing, or if it relates to information processing, we won't know whether or not these machines are conscious, and we may just lose sight of the problem. I mean, they certainly will seem conscious because we will build them that way, and it'll be fascinating and also ethically very consequential not to know which end is up there, because we won't know whether or not, you know, if we turn our computers off at that point, whether we're committing a murder. You know, it's just it may seem like we're committing a murder in the end, and we won't know whether or not that's a pure illusion if we haven't figured out how consciousness is related to the physics of things.
No. Well, listen, Sam, that's, I think, a good place to leave it. And like I said at the start, for someone who watched you and Hitch dish out all sorts of slaps back in the day, you know, through to discovering that you had a spiritual side and being a devotee of your interviews, like I said, it's one of probably only two or three other pods, I would say, that never leave my library, and the app as well. So, you know, I just want to express gratitude. I think it's important to do that. So just thank you very much indeed for coming on, and keep doing what you do, really.
Oh, nice, nice. Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you for listening to this week's conversation with Sam Harris. I'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, or ideas. Get in touch either via social media at Simon Mundy or via my website, simonmundy.com. For me, reflecting on this episode, understanding that our propensity to identify with thoughts and get lost in them causes the majority of our psychological suffering is really significant. We can see thoughts and simply choose to let them go, not resist them, but accept them and refuse to cling to them. Also, Sam's tip about not resisting uncomfortable emotions like anxiety or fear is immensely valuable. If you fully accept them, albeit not as a way to get rid of them, then the emotions themselves actually have a really short half-life and you can quickly return to equilibrium. And finally, I thought it was interesting that Sam's view of reality and the nature of consciousness does appear to have shifted somewhat. Having said fairly conclusively that consciousness was an emergent property of the brain in his book Waking Up, he admits to now being more agnostic. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed our chat. Let me know what you think. And a reminder about this week's newsletter, which you can sign up for on my website, simonmundy.com. In it, I share the best way I know to challenge the idea you have about who you are at a fundamental level, amongst other nuggets. If you could please share this episode with anyone who might be interested in it, I would be very grateful. Until next time, thanks and goodbye.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.